The Trump administration's peace plan for Gaza calls for an international force to disarm Hamas. It's hard to find experts who think this will work.
I am now declaring the International Stabilization Force is dead on arrival.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The latest on the path to peace in Gaza. In South Korea, multi-generational households are becoming less common. Lots of older folks are now living in big cities all alone.
Many seniors now live long. They live long, but not healthy.
Also today, the rebuilding in Jamaica is just beginning after Hurricane Melissa devastated parts of the island.
Everything ripped up, not the green, lush scenery that we know and love. That's all been changed.
That's all ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday.
Israel says it will reopen the Rafah border crossing in southern Gaza in the coming days. That would allow Palestinians to leave the territory, which has been extremely difficult for most of the 2 years of war.
But there is a big wrinkle. The Israeli government says that until militants in Gaza return all the remains of hostages, people will be allowed to leave Gaza through the Rafah crossing, but will not be allowed to enter. The announcement today was facilitated by President Donald Trump's 20-point Gaza peace plan. It went into effect in October. The nerve center for implementing the plan is located in an industrial zone in the southern Israeli city of Kiryat Gat. Reporter Tova Lazaroff went there and met the international team working toward peace in Gaza.
The center's work has become one of the few places where progress seems to be happening. The first phase of the ceasefire plan, which should have ended in October, was a cessation of fighting, an increase in humanitarian aid, and the release of hostages. That hasn't been completed yet. The second phase includes the disarmament of Hamas and the entry of an international stabilization force. That force would provide security, train Palestinian police, and demilitarize the strip. Globally, skepticism is high that phase two can occur as planned, with some even fearing that the war could be resumed. But inside the warehouse, stretched along a small paved street in an often forgotten part of the country, optimism is high. The American Army's U.S. Central Command and the Israeli Army are the main actors at the center. CENTCOM's Captain Tim Hawkins explains how the center is working now.
Its primary focus is in two areas. One is to coordinate the flow of humanitarian assistance, coordinate the flow of logistical support, and coordinate the flow of security assistance into Gaza. And secondly, help monitor implementation of the ceasefire.
The monitoring work includes real-time drone footage, Hawkins says. A map of Gaza divided into zones is projected onto one of the walls in front of long rows of black desks, office chairs, and computer screens. The sound of so many people speaking in all corners of the room at the same time creates a constant beat of humming voices. There are pipes stretched across the high ceiling amid fluorescent lights. Concrete pillars dot the room and green astroturf covers most of the floor. The force of 600 from 40 countries and international organizations, such as the UN, works in a large open room with the feeling of an airplane hangar.
It breaks out into six working groups that are focused on topics including humanitarian assistance, distribution, and delivery, but also engineering, security, intelligence, and other topics. So that just gives you a sense that their focus really is on doing everything they can to facilitate support that Gazan civilians need.
An Israeli military source says that people spend all day coming up with ideas trying to understand what can and can't be done in all the different arenas. Among the questions under discussion on many days is how to improve the flow of aid, how to clear out the rubble from 2 years of Israeli bombing, and how to create a support system for the International Stabilization Force. Those in the room, Hawkins says, understand how unique and significant their work is.
It is definitely something historic and special. It's an opportunity. And what we are focused on doing is maintaining this opportunity for the different parties to come together and take advantage of it by helping achieve lasting peace.
The UN Security Council ratified the Trump plan in November, including a loose mandate for the stabilization force. Ramiz Elkhabarov, U.S. Deputy Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, later told the council the center's work had helped improve what had been a catastrophic aid situation, but much more needs to be done. Among the sticking points are Hamas's delay in the promised return of all the deceased hostages, Hamas's refusal to disarm, and the absence of the promised international stabilization force. Middle East analyst Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib of the Atlantic Council spoke at an event put on by Media Central and Media Service in Jerusalem. He says there's no way an international force designed to get rid of Hamas will materialize.
I am now declaring the international stabilization force is dead on arrival. It has failed to materialize, and it is not going to happen in accordance to how the Trump administration envisioned it.
Al-Khatib says to remove Hamas from the picture, private military contractors, which are often used in conflicts from Iraq to Afghanistan, should be employed to spearhead the fight.
Then the International Stabilization Force can move in, and then you can have elements of the PA come in, and then you're just mopping up remnants of Hamas. There is a way. Hamas is not the only or the first or the last guerrilla group to have ever existed in a small piece of geography that is hiding behind civilians.
Retired Israeli Colonel Dr. Ofer Guterman is a researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies. He says whether an international stabilization force, the ISF, or a Palestinian one were to enter Gaza, it's unlikely either would want a full-on war with Hamas. He describes the issues this way.
Hamas is saying we are not going to disarm ourselves. The ISF and the Palestinian force are not ready and won't be ready for months. And Israel is saying we won't let reconstruction happen before we see demilitarization and disarmament. So how can it succeed?
Guterman says what's likely to happen is what he calls the Berlinization of Gaza.
If Trump's administration is pressing to move on, but Hamas doesn't agree to move on, then I refer you to Clause 17 in the 20 points agreement, which says that in the case that Hamas doesn't agree to move on with the plan, then the plan can move on without Hamas.
This scenario, says, would create a division, not unlike what occurred with Germany after World War II, when Berlin was split between East and West. Hamas would remain in control of the territory it now holds, about half of Gaza, where effectively little could happen. Construction and non-Hamas governance could begin, he says, in the areas of Gaza now under Israeli control.
So in this way, creating two entities, you know, one is, let's say, Hamastan, and the other is a, let's say, an Israeli security strip, which hopefully, gradually, more and more becomes a separate, alternative, competitive political territory and entity to the, let's say, the Hamastan territory.
And eventually, he says, that territory would be transferred to a future international stabilization force, which would allow Palestinians to begin rebuilding their homes and businesses in Gaza. For The World, I'm Tova Lazaroff in Jerusalem.
In India this week, a smartphone app sparked a big debate about government access to people's phones. It happened after an official directive was leaked to the public. The Indian government wanted tech companies to pre-install a state-owned security app on all new smartphones. Some companies, including Apple, refused to comply with the order, according to Reuters. Now the government has signaled it might back down, but the reaction to all of this has yet to cool off. Pratik Awagre is a tech policy researcher based in Bangalore.
What basically happened was there was a story that broke earlier this week that said, as you pointed out, device manufacturers and anyone who imports phones to India were directed to pre-install this app called Sanchar Sathi, which loosely translates into communication companion in English. And the application itself now has been around since earlier this year, and it's meant to be a service where you're able to report fraudulent calls, you're able to check if there are other phone numbers registered under your name, you're able to check the validity of your IMEI numbers and a couple of other features, a lot of which is also on the website today.
So in other words, if you were working in the government in India and you spotted fraud, or maybe in a business you spotted fraud, you'd use this app to kind of report it. Is that the idea?
So you're able to report if your phone has been lost or stolen, right? And then it asks you for your IMEI number. One of the other things that it was also doing was that when it was installed on the phone, it would be able to communicate with the centralized database.
Like a government centralized database.
And if that IMEI was reported lost, it would block the phone, and some devices were recovered that way. I don't know the exact numbers, but the government has put out a press release to this effect in the sense that, you know, it helped with some of that. So these were a couple of things that it did.
So spin that out for us, Pratik. What are people's concerns around this app?
The concerns were really stemming from a couple of things, right? One is that this was all happening essentially without people consenting to it, people agreeing to it. At one level, there was this concern about being forced to have an app on your phone and the risk or the potential privacy risks it would have. The second layer of that was about the precedent it sets, in the sense that now you're essentially saying that the state can say, hey, these are the apps you need to have on your phone. And once you open that door, what other apps can be mandated that way also is a question mark, right? Or in terms of whether this app itself at some point could be updated to do more, to track more things. Now, we don't have, I think, in the public domain, a really good teardown of this particular application and how it works today. But just in terms of once it's on your phone and you can't remove it, then in the future, what other features or what other abilities can be added to it where people would not be able to remove it, right? A lot of this stemmed from this belief that it was something that couldn't be removed. And look, the other thing is also in terms of, like we were discussing, that there is a sense now that there is a step back, right? So there's been a press release that come out, but the order itself hasn't, as of now, been formally revoked.
So this government order, as I said, was leaked. Is there a sense that the government was not ever going to let the public know, or that eventually they would let the public know that this app has been pre-installed on people's phones?
Partly speculative there, in the sense that, look, the app would be visible, right? So it's not like the app was invisible or people would not see it on the phone, right? You would know that the app is on your phone.
Right.
But just in terms of the procedure of how the order was issued, it's not clear whether there was ever an intention to publicly state that they've done this. There might have been. Now, again, the way things played out was that it was reported one day and there was a press release the next day. Now, we can only speculate whether the press release was already scheduled or whether it was done in response to the report going out. So there's a question mark there. But there is sometimes a tendency to not report some of these things in the public domain and just issue these orders. And then you often find out when someone leaks the order or it gets reported in the press.
So, Pratik, how common is it for the Indian government to make directives like this without public knowledge?
It's fairly common. It's hard to put a number per se, but it's not uncommon to have directives issued that go directly to the companies. And again, some of the regulation is written in such a way that the orders can't be made public. That's in a slightly different context. If you look at the regulation that talks about blocking websites or blocking social media accounts, that's written up in such a way that confidentiality is often invoked, right? So for example, if the government directed Twitter to take down, or X to take down, a post that I had submitted, and it gave Twitter XYZ reasons for doing so, Twitter wouldn't be able to tell me what those reasons are because there is confidentiality baked into the law itself, right? So in some cases, the laws are designed that way. In some cases, you also have like this, where an order is just sent out directly to companies and there isn't any sort of public consensus process that happens before it for something like this that potentially affects so many smartphone users.
And is what you're seeing now with this leaked order, how does public reaction compare to other directives that the government has tried to slide through?
So in this case, there's definitely been a stronger reaction than some other cases. And I think that probably explains why there seems to have been a change. Right now, of course, the government, it's unlikely that they will admit that they've taken a step back. But just judging by text of the order and how things change, it seems like they've shifted track a little bit. And so that's normally when there's pushback of this sort, or when there's pushback that this loud, sometimes there is a change in course.
Pratik Wagrey is a tech policy researcher based in Bangalore. He was walking us through the recent controversy in India around a government-mandated smartphone app.
As winter tourist season kicks off in the Caribbean, we check on Jamaica's recovery from Hurricane Melissa. That is next. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The World Bank and International Monetary Fund are stepping in to help Jamaica with nearly $7 billion in assistance for the ongoing recovery after Hurricane Melissa. The late October storm was one of the strongest on record in the Caribbean. It triggered devastating floods and killed more than 100 people across the region. Thera Edwards is a lecturer at the University of the West Indies.
There's pretty much a divide across the island, you know, in terms of east and west. The western end of the island was the hardest hit, but eastern end, while not the hardest hit, was not without having effects.
Edwards spoke with us today from Kingston, Jamaica, about those effects and the recovery efforts. She says 6 weeks after the storm, electric utility workers have restored power to about 80% of the island.
They have been working very hard. They were very proactive in that they brought in support from overseas companies to help them with restoration in the immediate aftermath. Don't want to leave out anybody, but I'll just hail our neighbors from Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, who sent not only staff, but bucket trucks to help with restoration of power in Jamaica. The terrain is difficult, and in some places, such as the parish of St. James, it's not just restoring power, but pretty much building out the whole power system from the ground up.
I'm wondering if you've been to any of the places that have been most impacted recently and what those look like, if you could paint us a picture.
I have only been to the center of the island, not the extreme western parishes. I've certainly seen lots of photo coverage and heard first-person accounts. The winds were some of the strongest ever recorded, and it left a lot of defoliation. When you look up on the hills and mountains of Jamaica, you see the brown, you see the loss of leaves, you see palm trees without fronds. So there's this brown, gaunt look to the landscape. You've had notable landmark places in Jamaica, like Holland Bamboo Avenue, as it's frequently known. We have Wyas Falls, and those places almost have an apocalyptic look. Everything ripped up. Not the green, lush scenery that we know and love. That's all been changed. So it adds to the desolation of the destroyed buildings or the buildings without roofs, is that the green, lush, tropical image you have of the island has been changed.
Do you know how many people are not able to live in their homes and are, you know, unsheltered or staying with friends or families or in shelters?
We have roughly 279,000 persons that are displaced based on household figures, and that's coming out of a report from yesterday.
So that's a lot of people still not in their homes.
That's a lot of people. Their numbers also say 74,000, with tarpaulings being distributed to cover their homes so that they at least can stay dry within their homes.
What's their long-term scenario? Is it clear how many people's homes can be repaired versus how many will need to rebuild completely?
It varies. One thing I do know is that we are determined and resilient. Persons went out and started, you know, salvaging, whether it was zinc for roofing or basically what can we do to make somewhere habitable. And it's not just houses. We've lost some significant heritage sites, you know, like the parish church in Black River, which has stood for centuries, and several other landmark cultural sites have been impacted.
The kind of things you can't really put a dollar figure on the damage.
You can't put a dollar figure on the damage. You know, it's history, it's sense of community. These are places that people have strong emotional and community ties to seeing. You know, it's part of their daily landscapes as they go to and fro. And so it also affects them mentally because they've lost the sense of the familial.
So what kind of a timeline are you looking at there until rebuilding is complete and things are back to pre-Melissa status quo?
I don't think we even really have a handle on that, because there are so many dimensions to what Jamaica pre-Melissa was. There are things such as the health sector, which had damaged hospitals and health centers. We have schools. A lot of schools were impacted severely and will not be able to open and have not reopened. We've had some schools where they were being used as emergency shelters. They have not been able to take back in their own students for classes because the shelter situation remains.
Melissa was one of the most powerful Atlantic storms ever recorded, as I have mentioned. I'm wondering, being there and living there, how it felt compared to any other storm that you have lived through.
I've lived through quite a few of the big ones. I lived through Gilbert. I lived through Ivan. I've been through Beryl last year and, of course, this year, Melissa. And I would say this one was a long wait. It was almost like waiting for something at a doctor's office. Mm. Like, you know, you're going for a shot and you don't like having vaccines or injections. You're afraid of needles. And you're sitting there waiting for your name to be called and you get to the stage of, can we just get it over with?
Right.
Because it was moving so slowly. It stalled over the seas. And every day when you thought, okay, it's going to be today or tomorrow, you heard not yet. So we had this very long buildup to the storm. And we knew it was going to be bad. And you just wanted to see what it was going to be, what it was going to do, and be on the other side of it, so to speak. And so there was a mental component, a mental health component, where persons just had extremely frayed nerves. And it's something that we are now looking at as another dimension to hurricanes and these increasing storms, is the mental toll of it, not just when your life is upended, but what happens as you wait and as you go through the storm.
Right. We have seen Jamaican tourism officials saying that the island is open for visitors. But in this conversation here, we're hearing there is still a lot of recovery and rebuilding to be done. Can you talk me through how both of those things are true at once? That tourists are welcomed and accepted, but there's still this damage.
All right. So it is very location dependent. Is it on the south coast? Is it on the north coast? What was the hotel like? Did it have a lot of open panes of glass? How close they were to the sea? Some places had not just wind damage, but they had storm surge, which brought the sea in. So the damage varies. So the places that can are opening, because today's December 3rd. And December 1 is traditionally the opening of the winter tourist season. So it's a double whammy being a late season storm, in that it came just before the start of the winter tourist season. So that is significant.
Huge part of the economy there.
Right.
Thierra Edwards is a lecturer at the University of the West Indies, and she spoke with us from Kingston, Jamaica. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Authorities in China are trying to create a new super region. The idea is to connect a cluster of big cities, including Hong Kong and Macau, into one huge integrated economy. In part three of a series from China this week, The World's Jeremy Siegel reports on how Chinese authorities are putting the young, tech-heavy city of Shenzhen at the center of this regional project.
When Chinese leader Xi Jinping entered a grand arena for the country's 15th annual National Games in November, a kind of local Olympics in China, there was something different in the air. It wasn't just that Xi had emerged victorious from a high-stakes trade meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump a week earlier. It was that these national games, unlike the previous 14 before them, weren't hosted by a single city, but the Greater Bay Area, China's new name for the Pearl River Delta, a region of some 11 cities, including Hong Kong, Macau, and Shenzhen. In the weeks leading up to the event, massive banners were hung throughout the three cities touting the Greater Bay Area as host. I spot one just outside of the Hong Kong sake bar where I meet Donald Low, who the bartender affectionately refers to simply as Professor.
Cheers.
Low is a professor of public policy at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology and something of an expert on China's ambitious Greater Bay Area Plan, an effort to transform the area traditionally known as the Pearl River Delta, the most populous region in the world, into a singular economic powerhouse.
Let's talk a little bit about the Greater Bay Area Initiative, because it's not really a term, at least like from what I've seen, you heard much about until somewhat recently, and now you see the region referred to that way a lot more. What's behind that?
The Greater Bay Area, the idea was to link up these key nodes, right, in the region, nine mainland cities like Hong Kong and Macau, and link them up through better connectivity, better infrastructure, transport infrastructure, highways, and so boost domestic consumption, boost domestic demand as an engine of growth.
But that growth has been uneven.
You know, every city except for Shenzhen has grown more slowly than the national growth rate of about 5%.
That's evident on the ground in Hong Kong, where tourism is a key part of the local economy. Iconic British-style double-decker buses used to be full of visitors year-round, but now it's not unusual to see one go by with just a handful of passengers. In Shenzhen, which Xi Jinping has explicitly stated will be the engine of the Greater Bay Area, the economy is booming thanks to a thriving tech industry. This is the voice of Kit, a 20-something man who was born in mainland China but moved to Hong Kong as a kid. He asked that we not use his last name. Kit now splits his time between Hong Kong and Shenzhen, just a 15 to 25 minute ride away thanks to a new bullet train connecting the cities. Kit says Shenzhen's growth in recent years has been extraordinary, and he plans to settle down there rather than Hong Kong because of the opportunity the city offers. Shenzhen was the first city in China to welcome foreign investment and market capitalism in the 1980s. At the time, Professor Low tells me, Chinese leaders wanted to replicate the success of Hong Kong, then under British rule.
The explicit mission, the explicit goal was for Shenzhen to learn as much as it can from Hong Kong. And it's very telling now that, you know, the question is now turned on its head. Now, what can Hong Kong learn from Shenzhen?
Under China's Greater Bay Area plan, Low says Hong Kong could benefit from a more symbiotic relationship with Shenzhen, serving as the financial center where Shenzhen-based tech companies can raise capital and get listed on the stock exchange. But so far, new connections between the two cities have mostly benefited the mainland. When I hop on the bullet train to Shenzhen, I can see that firsthand. Decades ago, the vast majority of intercity trips were made by mainlanders visiting Hong Kong. But today, there are double the number of border crossings into Shenzhen, and my train is full of Hong Kongers headed to the mainland to see the engine of the Greater Bay Area. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Hong Kong.
Pig farmers in northeast Spain are on high alert. There's been an outbreak of African swine fever among wild boar in the woods around Barcelona. This is the first such outbreak in three decades. The virus is deadly for swine. If it spreads to domesticated hogs, that could decimate Spain's multi-billion-dollar pork industry. The World's Jerry Haddon has our story from Barcelona.
At least 50 wild boar have been found dead, nine of them confirmed killed by the high fever brought on by the African swine virus. The outbreak is here in a huge forested park called Collserola, which sits above Barcelona and extends for miles. Nine boar doesn't sound like a lot, but the African swine virus is highly contagious. And this park has tons of boars. I know, because we live in Collserola. At night, out in the woods, the huge, hairy beasts can make a serious racket. Park officials say there are nearly 1,000 roaming out there. And all around the park are farms where ranchers raise the wild boar's domesticated cousins. Outside this slaughterhouse, not far from Barcelona, trucks line up to drop off their squealing loads. This is big business. Spain is the world's third largest producer of pork products. And Catalonia, here in the northeast, is ham central. At a local market in Barcelona, Ferran García Margarit's family has been selling cured, acorn-fed Serrano ham for 80 years. His top-shelf meat costs around $100 a pound.
Hay gente que no come carne, pero el jamón está a otro nivel.
Even people who don't eat meat make an exception for Spanish ham, Margarit tells me. It's next level. There's no ham like Spanish cured ham, he says, which is why we export so much of it. Spain's pork industry is valued at around $10 billion, but the mere threat of the swine fever is already taking a slice off profits. Since the appearance of the virus, 20 countries have banned or partially banned Spanish pork imports, including Mexico, China, and Great Britain, where trucks stuffed with chops and sausages have been stopped at the border. That's because the African swine fever virus is tough. It can even survive the curing process the meat undergoes, living on for months, say, in cold cuts. It does not affect humans, only pigs, but it still scares importers. In Spain, the stalled exports could create a national glut. Margarit says he worries that it could push his prices down, and without a single case yet found on a farm.
A veces estas cosas de que pueden pasar sobre, por ejemplo, la enfermedad porcina.
Things like this outbreak can happen, he says, but people get overly scared. We're talking about just a handful of cases, and it's far from a given that the disease will reach domesticated pigs. The government isn't so sure, and it's called in the army to help. At a temporary base of operations on the edge of the Coicerola Park, dozens of red emergency trucks from the Army's Special Disaster Unit roll past. One carries a dead boar found in the woods. The truck gets sterilized in case the virus has gotten on the chassis or wheels. The Army, with local engineers and police, have secured a 4-mile perimeter around where the first dead boar was found. Lieutenant Colonel Joaquin Nunez told reporters yesterday 150 soldiers were now moving slowly through that area.
Una 20 patrullas ahora mismo a pie. Una patrulla sobre el terreno tienen que ir rastreando minuciosamente.
We've got 20 patrols on the ground, he said, outside the base. They have to sweep the zone meticulously to find any dead animals. When we find them, he said, we hand them over to the specialists for analysis. As for any found alive within that perimeter, park rangers have orders to shoot them. Meanwhile, the rest of the Coicerola Park has been closed. That means millions of people from 64 towns on its edge must stay out until further notice. Like the military trucks, people's sneakers or bicycle tires could inadvertently pick up the virus and transport it somewhere else. As for where the disease came from, Oscar Ordeix is with the Regional Ministry for Agriculture.
No sabem l'origen encara, però sí que podria ser algun dels orígens.
We just don't know yet, he told reporters this week, but the culprit could be a ham sandwich, tossed, say, from the window of a moving car. Should a wild boar then eat said sandwich, that could set the spread of the virus in motion. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
In Ukraine, the military relies heavily on civilians to keep the troops well supplied. They send food, drones, and medical kits to the front lines. They even provide vehicles to evacuate the wounded. Reporter Emily Cohen traveled with a volunteer convoy delivering donated ambulances to Ukraine. She met one woman for whom these missions have become a kind of calling.
It's 6 a.m. outside of a hotel parking lot in Katowice, Poland. A line of ambulances is warming up in the cold morning air. I hop in the passenger seat of a mustard-yellow Mercedes Sprinter ambulance. 44-year-old Oksana Berleva is driving.
I came the day before yesterday. In a bus, I spent 22 hours from Kyiv to Katowice. It's crazy.
She's here to drive a donated ambulance back to Ukraine. This is her 19th trip transporting SUVs, trucks, and ambulances to her country. But when the war started nearly 4 years ago, she didn't imagine this would be her role.
But there is sunset in our nation, that we woke up, all of us woke up in 22nd
Literally and figuratively, she and her neighbors were handing out coffee to soldiers one day and loading magazines into Kalashnikovs the next.
They stood on my near my house. I gave them coffee, and they taught everything this because they didn't know how to do it. They were in every village, in every house, big house with flats. It was some guy or veteran or just a colonel or somebody who had experience of war. And he said, we just meet here.
Much of Ukraine's defense runs this way, not through official government channels, but through people like Berleva, regular citizens on Telegram channels, raising money, planning what to do. In fact, there's a volunteer group, the Territorial Defense Forces, made up of regular people fighting alongside the country's army. Berleva eventually found her place helping her country as a driver.
Usually the most popular requests for volunteer drivers in Ukraine is, we go tomorrow, can you?
This time, she got a few hours' notice. A used ambulance dealer in France working with an American NGO had lined up a convoy of more than two dozen vehicles heading into Ukraine. She grabbed a backpack, her phone charger, and cigarettes. On the road, she relaxes a little. She listens to music, podcasts, her favorite band, Kozak System. She's able to get a few nights of sleep in a hotel without air raid alarms.
I am not a shopaholic in my real life. I don't go to shops and everything. But here, when I see that there are no alarms, the mall will not close now, I just walk.
Berleva is one of just two Ukrainians on this trip, which is a mix of international volunteers, though largely Americans, veterans, former Peace Corps volunteers, curious do-gooders. Most of her missions are small ad hoc efforts organized by Ukrainians themselves. And when she crosses into the EU to pick up vehicles, it's women making the trek with her.
Some men are on the war, other men are hiding from the war, and not many guys can pass the border from Ukraine. They are not allowed. It's very difficult to get permission to leave Ukraine.
She'll go straight to wherever the car is, sometimes days of travel, just to turn around and drive back.
We take my one small car of a woman, four or five drivers, go to another country, and then one girl lives in this car, and we take four other cars to Ukraine, like this. Sometimes we have train, buses, everything, trains, just to reach a country where the car is.
It's like a relay race across borders. A car in Germany, Spain, or France, find it, pick it up, drive it partway, and then hand it off. It's often a gamble what condition the vehicles will be in, hopefully good enough to make the long trek back to Ukraine, and then to the east, where they must withstand roads pockmarked with rubble and potholes. Before the war, Berleva owned a coffee shop in Kyiv. Now she's a manager for a cosmetics distribution company. She works remotely, which means she can disappear for a few days to drive across the continent. Her husband is on the front lines in eastern Ukraine.
When will you get to see your husband again?
I don't know. It's never possible to know.
Berleva sighs. But suddenly her eyes light up. She spots a Land Rover.
Red Discovery.
She has a friend with this same model SUV. He was an influencer of sorts. Driving across Europe and Africa, he collected stickers from the countries he visited. Berleva says his car became a symbol of freedom.
Ugh, it's a disturbing topic. You know, when I drive cars previously, I didn't think about all the things that you ask me. I was just looking around, thinking about car, other cars.
She tells me that before the war, she and her husband had a dream of traveling.
We had a small Volkswagen T4 multivan, which transformed in a bed. It's possible to live in it. And we had some trips on the our sea on in Odessa, in Carpathians, in Ukraine. And we had a dream to travel around Europe by such after one.
Where I live in Wyoming, people also chase this dream for powder days and sunsets, calling it van life. For some, it's freedom. For others, van life is the only way to afford a home in a place that has gotten too expensive.
Berleva and I are the same age. We've probably scrolled the same photos on social media. Mountain roads, little kitchens with tables that fold out.
And he dreamed to have another big car for this to transform to everything. And now when I have such travels, I tell him about which cars I see, what is here. So, and we dream more than we will go to our trip a little later.
Van life, maybe with an ambulance.
And he asked me to find some empty car, like ambulance, but empty, to transform it. I say, no, when you be back after the war, we will do everything.
Berleva pauses, tears up, and then looks down at her phone.
7 minutes. Time passed quickly when we spoke. Ah, but thank you that you asked which questions you put me, but it's really hard to realize everything in words and to express it.
We're almost at our stopping point for the day, a rest area before crossing the border back into Ukraine.
The easiest way is to be a refugee from Ukraine, just to leave the country, and that's all. But maybe those who are in Ukraine now, they write the history of this land.
Berleva chooses to drive. It's both her act of hope and a way to experience a taste of van life, a dream on hold for nearly 4 years. For The World, I'm Emily Cohen, Lviv, Ukraine.
In South Korean cities, it's not uncommon to see groups of retirees hanging out in public parks and playing board games. The most popular ones are Janggi and Paduk, also known as Go. But in South Korea's capital, Seoul, there's now one fewer place for seniors to get their game on. Jason Strother visited the park where board games are banned and discovered that the real reason senior citizens show up is not necessarily to play games, but for something more essential.
A stone and brick wall with a wide wooden gate separates the city from Topgol Park, one of the central business district's only green spaces. Kim Yun-sun is sitting on a bench under a pine tree with a couple of friends. I ask the 88-year-old what he likes most about this park. Kim says it's a good place to meet others around his age and have coffee or tea together. He says he and his friends come here almost every day. And that's Topgol Park's reputation. It's a hangout place for elderly men. It was also known for board game matches that could get a little rowdy. Until recently, that is. This past July, after receiving hundreds of complaints of disorderly conduct, authorities banned playing Paduk and Janggi anywhere near the park. Good riddance, says Kim. Those guys were out of control, he says. They drank a lot and didn't care if they got arrested. They acted like they had nothing to lose. But not everyone sees it that way. Jo Song-yeop is sitting by himself on the steps of a tiled roof pavilion. He's 83 and says playing these games together was one reason why many seniors came here. And as Jo knows well, coming to the park can be a lifeline. He says he comes here 2 or 3 times a week because there's a soup kitchen nearby, and free packaged lunches are also handed out to seniors. Around 500 people line up for the meals, he estimates. Joe lives alone in a rented room. That's not uncommon for South Koreans in their latter years.
They experience social isolation. It's increasing dramatically in recent decades.
Grace Chung is a family studies professor at Seoul National University.
Traditionally, Korea was very much about like multi-generational living, you know, but that's pretty much disappeared in urban areas. That's not the norm.
Compounding the isolation is poverty, Chung says. Among wealthy nations, South Korean senior citizens are the poorest. That's according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's also one of the world's fastest aging societies. 20% of the population is over 65, and that number is expected to rise. Chung says many retirees have low or no pensions, and their families can't afford to care for them. One positive thing, she notes, is that seniors have access to great medical treatment thanks to universal health care.
But, you know, when it comes to, like, long-term care, many seniors now live long, and they live long but not healthy. Like, a lot of them, like, struggle with, like, chronic illness, limited mobility, emotional loneliness, and things like that. I don't think Korea is there yet.
But there are organizations trying to offer alternatives to loneliness. An end-of-year recital was underway when I visited the Seoul Senior Welfare Center. Over 1,000 elderly men and women come here every day. They participate in all kinds of classes, from learning how to play traditional instruments to studying philosophy. General Manager Yoon Beetna says the center does more than just provide fun activities for these seniors. It also helps them cope with the mental health challenges of aging. She says some people come here with suicidal thoughts. They're struggling with financial pressure or having difficulty caring for a spouse. So the center has counselors on hand to talk about depression and also offers family and group therapy sessions. For some seniors, coming to the center gives them new purpose. I spoke with 74-year-old Hwang Kyu-hwa just before her dance troupe's performance. She says her husband died about 10 years ago, and her son lives in Japan. If I were home alone, she says, I'd skip meals. But here, I always eat together with friends, and the food in the cafeteria is pretty good, too. Others come here for the games. In one room at the center, dozens of men sit around tables playing what else but paduk. They're placing white and black marble pebbles on their boards. I ask one of the players, 80-year-old Jo Young Song, if he ever played these games at Topgol Park. He says no, it wasn't appealing. It's a lot nicer to play inside here at the center. At the park, people were just playing on the street, and it was chaos. The chance to play is enough to bring some seniors here. But still, the chance to just not be alone is enough for others to spend their days at Topgol Park, even without the games. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
Playing for any Premier League soccer team is a pretty big deal. Manchester City's Erling Haaland has just entered an even more elite group, the 100 Club.
Jeremy Doku. And it was left for Haaland. And there's the landmark goal. 100 in double quick record time in the Premier League.
Haaland scored his 100th Premier League goal in a match against Fulham last night. The Norwegian striker reached the milestone in record time. It took just 111 games to score those 100 goals.
Doesn't take much math to know that's pretty impressive. After the game last night, the 25-year-old said he knew how close he was to the record before kickoff.
That's what I tried to do. I tried to help the team with scoring goals. And yeah, that's my job.
No big deal. Haaland has scored some of those goals off of his right foot. More of them have been headers.
Which is no surprise because he's 6'5", but most of those goals, 71 of them, came off of his left foot.
The lefty has helped Man City win lots of games, and he has done well for his home country of Norway, too. Norway's national team has qualified for next summer's World Cup for the first time since 1998. Many fans credit Erling Haaland for leading them there.
And that's going to do it for us today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Also, check out our original reporting on YouTube. You can subscribe to our channel there as well. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. by the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
PRX. From PRX.